science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
At least I have no shame. How are you, Alan?
I'm very well, Will. How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
I'm great.
Good.
I'm enjoying this nice weather this morning-ish. Oh, no, it was nice before. Now there's a bit of cloud, but hey.
Oh, it's not too terrible. It's not raining.
What are we talking about today? Because I was looking through the links you sent through, and they're all very interesting. A couple I don't really understand wholly, but that's why you're here, Alan.
Well, I was thinking we have to do something for the World Cup, seeing as you know, it's happening at the moment. I see Lisa's not here today, no, she's obviously off celebrating.
Oh, no, she is here today. She's here. Working on her report.
She's not in here.
Although she was celebrating this morning.
I'll
tell you that much.
She was, yes. Yeah, I didn't know really who to go for, you know, because Belgium hadn't made it to the final before, but France is nice, you know, so who do you go for? I know who I'm going for tomorrow, though.
Who?
Who do you think?
I mean, I don't pay attention, so I want to know.
Croatia, go the Croats.
That's not what I expected, but hey, okay.
Oh, okay. Anyway, so World Cup and everything, and it's been a massive success, and you see all these people having a great time in Russia, and you sort of think, well, why the hell can't the world just kind of get on like it's getting on at the
moment? That's the big question, isn't it?
I know, it is. It's ridiculous, you know. So everyone's had a great old time. Nobody's been dicks, and except some of the players. But... so what relationship could there possibly be between the World Cup and science, you ask, Will?
I do ask. I asked exactly that question just then.
So way back in the 1980s, there were a couple of research groups, one in Sussex University in England and one in Rice University in Texas. Mm-hmm. And they were interested in... seeing what happens to molecules, or seeing what sort of molecules get created if you blat them with lasers, essentially.
That's a great word, blat.
Yeah. And the guy in England was really interested in molecules that occur in outer space. And you get all sorts of weird sort of carbon-containing molecules out in outer space, and just sort of big, long chains of carbon, and nobody knows sort of why they exist, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Quick question before we continue on. How do we know about these molecules in space? Do we collect them?
No, we don't collect them, but they have very obvious spectral signatures. So we analyze the light, essentially, that they give off, and from the light that they give off, you can figure out what they are. You
know? I'm already amazed, and we've just started the show.
So anyway, he's interested in these weird sort of carbon-containing molecules. And these guys in the States had this technique that they could analyze sort of unusual molecules. And so the two got together, essentially, and what they did was to blat a piece of carbon with a laser beam. And what they found was these weird molecules that were given off. And these weird molecules all looked like they contained 60 carbon atoms, and that was it. And that's very, very strange. Only carbon atoms and 60 of them. And they were sort of thinking, well, you know, how can this be? What is it? Because as you, dear listeners, all know, the only two allotropes of carbon, we know what allotropes are, don't we?
Nope.
No. But you're just about to learn. So allotropes are different forms of the same element, okay? Two allotropes of carbon. One is graphite. The other one is...
You're asking the wrong people here, Alan.
The other one is diamond.
Oh, nice.
Okay, so diamond and graphite are made up of just solely carbon atoms, okay? But they've got very, very different structures. So graphite is made of sheets, and that's why it's a good lubricant. And carbon atoms bonded in sheets, but the sheets aren't bonded together, so they can slide. And diamond is made of carbon atoms all bonded to each other in three dimensions, in what we call a tetrahedron. And those were the only two forms of carbon that was known. And which one's the most stable?
Graphite?
I mean,
yes. You went for the non-obvious one. So all of you folks who've got diamond rings, you'll be horrified to know that they are slowly but surely turning into graphite.
Oh,
because
no.
Graphite is a stable form of carbon. Yes.
So what you're saying, Alan, is diamonds are not forever.
No, indeed they're not. Indeed they're not. But it will take a few gazillion years for them to change. It's a very slow process.
Is that the official term, gazillion?
Indeed, yes.
Fantastic.
So anyway, those are the only two sort of carbon forms that were realized or that were recognized. And then they did this experiment and they found that they would get these weird molecules that contain 60 carbon atoms. And totally unprecedented. Right, so here's the link with the World Cup. So they sat around trying to think, right, what the hell shape would a bunch of 60 carbon atoms make? And so they sat at home, in fact, cutting out hexagons and stuff like that, trying to make this shape...
A three-dimensional
shape. And they found they couldn't do it with hexagons, but if they had a mixture of hexagons and pentagons, then they could make this beautiful round shape that looks just like, ta-da, a soccer ball. There you have it.
There's the link.
Cool.
And it also looked very much like geodesic domes that R. Buckminster Fuller made, who was a famous architect. And so they called this molecule Buckminster Fullerene. They were going to call it footballine or something like that. But if you look at a football, I'm not sure they do it anymore, but back in the days when they sort of hand-stitched them and stuff like that, you'll see that a football is made up of alternating hexagons and pentagons, all tied up together. And it's got 60 vertices, and those 60, and at those 60 vertices in this molecule, in this weird molecule, was situated a carbon atom. And so this was a molecule called C60, and it won these guys a Nobel Prize in 1996.
I always ask this question, Alan, but applications of said... molecule.
Oh, this stuff was going to change the world. Don't you worry about that. Was going to change the world.
Yeah.
No, in fact, it's started a big new field in science. So these molecules, for example, are superconducting at a very high temperature, which is an interesting property to have. And if you take these molecules and sort of flatten them out and then take them off with sticky tape, if you take basically graphite and you take sticky tape across the top of it and peel it off, you can peel off a single layer of graphite, and that's called graphene, and that also won the guys who discovered that a Nobel Prize as well.
Wow.
Quite simply, that's literally what they did. They took sticky tape on graphite and they managed to peel off a single layer. And graphene's got all sorts of weird properties as well. So
that's crazy, considering how much people do in scientific fields to make things happen, that they just use sticky tape.
It sounds too simple, you know.
Well, there was a little bit more to it than that, but that was the original way of making it.
Yeah.
So basically, these guys opened up a whole new field of carbon chemistry. So organic chemistry is sort of the chemistry of carbon, but this is sort of inorganic carbon chemistry, and fascinating. And it's all sorts of different shapes. So C60 looks like a soccer ball, and then they made this thing called C70 that looks like a rugby ball.
What sports next?
I know.
Well, I mean, there's not really many different shapes of
sizes, smaller,
and the C84, and the there's all sorts of these things. So it really is interesting stuff.
Funnily enough, we're going to be talking about shapes and sizes of balls later on in the show.
You didn't just go there.
I did. That's a joke that you might get later on.
And he segues beautifully.
I feel like
into...
you've been waiting for the.
No. We're not segueing into that one quite yet. We're going to save that one for last.
Oh, okay. Possibly wise.
This second story is about. We always talk about journals and how some of them are good and some of them are bad in terms of the scientific community.
Yep.
The one we're talking about today is.
Well. It's a journal called Psychology and Psychotherapy. Sorry, it's not even called that. what is it actually called? I've got it. Yep, it is. It's called Psychology and Psychotherapy Research Study. That's the name of the journal. Mm-hmm. Interesting title. A quick thing for the listeners who don't know how science works. Science works is that you do some experiments, you then write them up, and then you submit them to a journal for publication.
Yeah.
And if... And what the journal does with that manuscript is they send it on to some reviewers, sort of 2, 3, 4 reviewers who are experts in that particular field. They send back their opinions, which is either yes, publish it, or no, don't publish it. Mm. And then the editor writes back to you and say, yes, you're accepted, or no, you're not. Now, generally, hopefully, the journal that you send it to is a good reputable journal, like things like Nature and Science and Proceedings and the National Academy of Sciences and et cetera, and these really, really good journals. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously not everyone can get into the really good journals because it's a difficult thing to do. And only the very, very, very best research is put into those very good journals. So then you've got the next tier journals, you know, next tier down, and, you know, they're pretty good too, and it's good to be in those. And then you've got the absolute rubbish journals.
Like this one.
Now, sadly, in the past few years, given the rise of the internet and the ease with which one can publish things on the internet, there's been a profusion of publishers that are less than, let's say, truthful, okay? And they're called predatory publishers. And basically, they promise you that they will publish your stuff. And the way that academia works these days, it's very important to publish lots because your promotions, etc., depend on you getting published in so-called international journals. So if you come upon a journal that basically promises to give you a yes when you send in your stuff, for a fee, of course.
Oh, right.
For a fee.
So it's all about making money in that regard.
It's all about making money. So these guys will basically publish anything. Now, they promise that they will have your... paper peer-reviewed within 5 days, which is absolutely impossible. You can't do that. And they'll have it accepted in a week sort of thing, which is absolute rubbish.
It's dodgy.
It's dodgy, but sadly, lots of people are fooled by this.
I love the title of this paper that we're about to talk about.
Indeed.
You can read it.
Okay, so, and again, some background to this. Some people decide to take advantage of these predatory publishers and see if they actually will publish absolutely anything. And this is an example that they do. So this paper is testing interhemispheric social priming theory in a sample of professional politicians, bracket, a brief report. And essentially what this paper is looking at is whether one can figure out one's political affiliations by whether one wipes one's bum with one's right or left hand.
What?
Yep.
Yeah. And so that's what this guy, whose name is Jerry J. Lewis.
Yeah. The names in this.
From the Institute of Interdisciplinary Political and Fecal Science in England.
Fantastic.
And so he decided to make up a fake paper, submit it to this particular journal and see if they would publish it. And by golly, they did. Surprise, surprise. So the truth is that they will actually print anything. So a couple of sort of things from the paper itself. They're talking about their statistics. They say these are excellent fit statistics, although the model makes little sense. A second weakness was noted by one of our cinnamon anonymous reviewers, Dr. IP Daly. Now, if they don't sort of figure out that that's a joke name, then really, yeah.
Well, going beyond that, even that joke name, I'm just looking at it here, and they're talking about the politicians that they caught up with on the street to ask them what hand they wiped with. There's Boris Johnsky, Theresa Maybe. I don't even want to say the rest of these. Some of them are just unpronounceable.
And Nigel F. Arraj told the research assistant to bog off when asked the hand wiping question. Literally. And of course, then, given that you've got the right and the left and you've also got the centre, then they sort of asked the question. I can't help wondering, though, about the ass-wiping practices of political centrists and independents. Do they alternate hands or do they use both hands at the same time?
I mean, now we're just asking the real question. Yeah. Yes. I mean, if we're drawing correlations, we might as well.
Ah, oh, dear.
I can't believe this got approved. Well, I mean, yes. I know it's fake and dodgy or whatever.
Yeah. But There was a very, very famous case of this many, many years ago where I think a bunch of, he might have been a physicist or something like that, where he submitted a paper about a hermeneutic look at quantum mechanics or something to a sociology journal. And it was just completely made up, complete bollocks, and the journal accepted it. That's the very, very famous case of this. Now, that was actually sort of a supposedly reputable journal. And they got caught up in that. It's called the Sokal hoax, if anybody wants to look that up. S-O-K-A-L, Alan Sokal was the guy's name. But it just shows that, you know, these so-called journals, they will publish anything, and you got to pay them, I don't know, $700 US or something like that. Mm. And obviously, if there wasn't a demand for it, then people wouldn't be doing it. But the mere fact that people need to publish, and sadly they'll stoop to publishing in these sorts of journals, which really isn't a good look.
And at the end of the day, that's going to end up on the internet. It's going to end up on people's Facebooks because someone's I mean, obviously this one's a piss take, and if you take it seriously, then who knows. But there will be plenty of other publications.
There are. This is not the first, and it certainly won't be the last.
Deceptive science.
But you know, the people who are publishing it don't care. They're just out to make money.
But isn't there like a check and balance on who can go around calling themselves a journal thing?
No.
Really?
Not. No. You could start a journal tomorrow.
Maybe I will. And sounds like I'm going to earn a little bit of money from this as well.
And, you know, if you do it well enough, I guess people will be quite happy to publish with you. And that's sad. But you should be able to figure out what's a good journal from a crap journal. So
who knows, someone might get fooled and use it for their next essay. We don't know.
They could yeah. I mean, there is always that danger, but it's terrible, and it shouldn't be happening, but it is. So I don't know how to combat this.
Yeah, I'm gonna wait. Here's my segue.
Okay.
Journals and science are treacherous, which leads me on to this next story about a very treacherous study. Well, not treacherous, but It basically ended up with a person who was conducting a scientific study ending up with lots of photos of penises.
Indeed it did, yes. So I'm very interested to read this over the weekend. So this is to do with Dr. Alicia Walker, who is an assistant professor of sociology at Missouri State University. And she wanted to do a study of the relationship between penis size and self-esteem. And, you know, I guess when you think about it, there might be something to look at there. And so in terms of the experiment itself, or the survey, I guess, so she wanted up to around about 3,500 participants, all of whom are over 22. And she was going to have survey questions about size, self-image, sexual relationships, and sexual habits. And importantly, she wanted photos of the measurement process to ensure that everyone was sort of measuring things the same way, consistent measurement techniques, which is all sort of important. Now, this was then picked up by the press, as such things often are, and they concentrated on one particular area, and they essentially concentrated on the small guys. And they were saying, oh, this study is all about, you know, small guys and, you know, their lack of self-esteem. And once it was sort of publicized like that, then she realized that this was going to skew the results of the survey, because then this wouldn't encourage big guys, as it were, to submit and talk about, you know, the fact that they do have high self-esteem. So it was very much biasing the sample. And not only that, she also, once this got made public, she got all sorts of bloody emails and phone calls and everything, sort of very, very derogatory ones from guys, sort of asking the question, what the hell does a woman think that she's doing this particular study for? You know, how can you do this as a woman? And blah, blah, blah. It was, you know, very, very bizarre. And it got to the point where she basically called off the study because of all of this. And it's just crazy.
I was saying on my news roundup this morning that this is almost telling of what she was trying to find out. I mean, if it's such a touchy
fair
subject.
Point, fair point. No pun intended, yes.
Touchy. Oh, God. Alan.
Well, you went there.
I'm allowed to go there. You're the guest. yeah, well, it's a valid study. I mean, you can suggest that, and it's a study, and if people are going to skew it, they're going to...
Well, the sad thing was that after she called it off, then she started getting phone calls from guys who really supported this and really wanted to participate in it, and basically said that, you know, I can't talk to anybody or any of my guy mates about this because I'll get ridiculed and everything. And, you know, would have been a really good side to the research, I guess. But so, you know, she just really had to call it off because of all the abuse and stuff that she was getting. It just seems really...
Such a toxic masculine culture that we have, you know, where like this woman cannot go around doing the study. And
very bizarre, very, very, very strange. And I guess what they did find as well, you know, when these things were submitted, that, you know, lots of guys were being, excuse the pun, dicks about it. And basically, you know, sort of sending in photos of SpongeBob and things like that, and, you know, sort of false data, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So obviously it would have been better if this wasn't publicised as widely possibly, because then you might not have got, or she might not have got the backlash that she got. But, it's a valid scientific study, and it could have yielded some interesting results, but I guess we'll never know.
I do wonder what the response would have been if a guy had been leading the research, you know.
Yeah.
Would they have joked around with him or taken him seriously?
I think it would have been just as bad. I think it doesn't really matter.
Yeah. I hate to say it, but I think you're probably right. But it's just, again, we'll never know.
Well, we'll leave it there then. Thank you very much, Alan. We can all sit back and think about that one for a bit. We'll be back after these breaks.
That was Dear Science.